As a child, I was often told of Uncle Manoli, "Come on, John, do your job or you'll turn out to be like your Uncle Manoli." This was a constant refrain, puncturing my childhood like a looming rain cloud. Who was Uncle Manoli, living far away on a Greek island called Kythera? What did he do that made my parents and relatives warn me about him? Playing games in the broken glass-speckled dirt amongst empty soft drink bottles that needed stacking, and watching the rolling shapes of clouds above me, I would often think of Uncle Manoli. Uncle Manoli, the legendary encyclopedist, the restless, lazy misanthrope whose spitting tick in unison with his worry beads dancing between his fingers would forge a hypnotic spectacle of synchronized, world-weary solitude. Uncle Manoli and Kythera, island of wild herbs, stormy seas, deep ravines, braying donkeys, almond trees in the dusk, empty broken-down houses, desolate village squares, and Dechirico clock towers, two distant phantoms stamping my life to come.
I was going to put another piece on called Aura, which is a meditative piece on a romantic landscape in the context of the new emerging technological sublime in a moving image culture. But I think because we're running out of time, I'll just go into my little spiel here, if you don't mind. Four little quotes to begin with. The past and the present that they felt above them were waves of one and the same ocean, Jean-Luc Godard. Second quote. Let's have some new cliches, Sam Goldwyn. Three, me, I pursue an image, no more, Gerard de Nerval. And fourthly, from an early age, I stalked movies for a clue to a life that I didn't understand, Chris Pettit. What I wish to do today is make a few discursive and autobiographical observations, if I may, concerning my own work as an artist and writer for the last 30 years. I will do so in the hope that my remarks will be provisional, exploratory, in the critical sense of just carrying a conversation with you as we're having a cup of coffee together and discussing one or two things that may be of matter to us both. Questions concerning contemporary moving image practice and the possibilities of transgeneric experimentation of the mainstream and the peripheral in our cultural and personal lives. And where may the so-called experimental edge be located these days, if at all, in contemporary cinema? And in doing so, I will speak about my own trajectory as a cinephile, from a time when the cinema was essentially celluloid and communal in terms of seeing and hearing it, to a time now when it has fragmented in so many complex, dynamic and uncharted ways with the advent of the VCR, digital technology, the internet, global DVD cinephilia, etc., etc. Thus, what are these dramatic, aesthetic, cultural, historical and technological shifts have taken place for the last three decades or so, if not more, cinema itself has also moved, as we all can attest to the gallery and the museum world. Today, Nam June Paik's prescient pronouncement, and I quote, that as the collage technique replaced oil paint, the cathode tube will replace the canvas, is an everyday reality. Video has substantially altered the status of the work in our post-computer, post-cinema age. Moving images are ubiquitous in contemporary art and cinema's expanding cultural and representational itineraries in so many different contexts outside the film theatre, particularly in the art gallery, the museum, on the internet, where art and film are profoundly interacting in so many critical ways. This cross-pollination that is taking place between art and film in today's museographic space has had momentous mnemonic implications for the contemporary gallery goer and for our convulsing cultural landscape in the main. Therefore, the changing geography of the museum culture and the multifaceted interaction between art, film, television, video, etc., shaping contemporary exhibition is, as Giuliano Bruno once said, eloquently noted, and I quote, returning spectatorship to exhibition. All these relatively new intertextual developments in the cinema, the visual arts, and the new technical media are clearly increasingly evident in the conceptual, formal, and technological architecture of our contemporary ifoscape. Cinema's always been, since modernism and before in the late 19th century, a history of polarities. And what we are undeniably witnessing at the present within the art world is just one more telling expression of the medium in its unceasing, fertile evolution. Furthermore, the contemporary avant-garde experimental practices of the camera-based arts, including the film medium and overall the visual arts, including performance, during the last several decades, denote the key emergence of what Rosalind Krauss has once called the post-medium condition in our audiovisual culture. Krauss's thesis is that the cinema can never be seen to have an essence in a single medium. A lot of commentators have spoken about this, Noel, Carroll, etc., because of its aforementioned constant technological evolution and its shifting integration with other forms like painting, literature, theatre, sculpture, science, journalism, anthropology, etc. Consequently, the differential condition of film has meant that the artists and film and video makers since the 1990s and earlier have been working with low-cost, highly-quality digital editing and imaging technologies and are engaged in the unfolding intertextual enterprise of post-cinema. Jeffrey Scholar notes in his recent study of how the more innovative experimental filmmakers of our generation are negotiating the question of pastness and its intricate representation in their works based on the realisation that to work in film as a post-medium artist in an art form that no longer possesses an essential medium specificity is by its very act to contemplate multiple relationships between pasts and presents. And that's where I work in. I work in that the art of confusion, interference, to quote Ballou, to quote Michel Serres, etc. We need to ask ourselves, what exactly is the attraction the cinema holds for contemporary artists? What takes place when the projected image is located from the black box to the white cube, and when cinema, classic, avant-garde, whatever, independent, art house, is recontextualized within the gallery and or museum and museum world? What are the relationships that have and are taking place between cinema and film and video installations? And how did the projected image find its way into the established art historical discourse of modernity? In other words, the mixed media zeitgeist that prevails in a contemporary art world, aptly defined by Raymond Ballou, a critic whose markedly resonant probes into seeking new ways of seeing, interacting, and inventively talking about the mutating multimedia artworks and hybrid presentation systems that surround us is exemplary, to say the least, as, and I quote, the aesthetics of confusion, suggesting that cinema and the new technologies are moving towards being part of the same developing multi-layered narrative or audiovisual creativity. By historicising the radical aesthetic of seminal projected image practices of the 50s, 60s, 70s, etc., one is able to discuss key works of the past in order to provide new light on contemporary image installations. However, in doing so, we need to remind ourselves, as I do constantly, that the critique of cultural amnesia as a mass-mediated malady of late capitalist culture is not new in itself, as is believed in certain academic circles, as Andreas Huston, Columbia Professor of German Studies, has pointed out. For example, witness Theodor Adorno's, Walter Benjamin's, Martin Heidegger's interwar writings on culture's obsession with memory and the fetish quality of mass cultural forms. Thus, this important issue blights our cultural and epistemological endeavours to discuss contemporary moving image practice and its shifting complexities in a top techno-culture. Lamentably, it is systematically embedded in our academic funding and museological institutions and the theoretical frameworks of interpretation. Critically then, cultural amnesia is conveyed by our computer-inflected media in our age of consumption, information networks, and global capital. What is interesting to note is how many artists' deployment of film in the 1990s, particularly Hollywood film, according to Chrissy Ells, is partly to do with the wish to connect to the idea of film as a socialising medium of communication. Following Marshall McLuhan's prediction in the 1960s that where the 19th century had been about obsessed with privacy, the 20th century would be obsessed with communication. Ells argues that artists are seeking to engage with, and I quote, the connective tissue that film creates. But as we know, the relationship between film and art is, by and large, a one-way street, by and large. Artists love film, but the film world seems to be indifferent to this salient fact. Hence, the art and film worlds have been always represented according to the conventional wisdom in Anthony McCall's apt words as, and I quote, a double helix, spiraling close together around one another without quite meeting. But as artists, filmmakers, educators, spectators, curators, etc., we know that for many complex reasons, aesthetic, cultural, historical, and technical, the double helix metaphor with its illusory asymptotic character is generally speaking a serviceable one, but not entirely quite accurate. For why else have we gathered here today? To speak of one's owner, which I will briefly, and of one's writing practice is always a difficult thing to do in the light of D.H. Lawrence's cautionary observation, never trust the artist, trust the tale. So, and more recently, what Deleuze had to say in 1977, when he persuasively spelled out that many elaborate biographical, sociocultural, and philosophical complexities that are pertinent to the act of explaining oneself to any given audience. This was once perfectly illustrated to me one day in the early 1980s when I watched on my television set Jean Genet, the French novelist and playwright, being interviewed by a BBC TV crew. Within a number of few minutes, Genet, in his scornful, scatological manner, upturned the proverbial apple cart and interrogated the Oxbridge-educated interviewer about the ideological fictions and limitations of what it means to conduct an interview, or to explain oneself, as I'm trying to do here, to someone else, in the context of the customary ingrained generic banalities of a television interview. The essay form, for me, has always attracted me because, as an artist and a writer, it's given me this pliable intertextual capacity to act as a go-between, like a T-boy. Shuffling, to quote Serge Dany, between cinema, video, new media, literature, and critical theory. I've always been fascinated with the idea of cinema, video, and installation as writing. The phantasmatic notion of film and video as a form of sound image performance writing has always haunted me since the 1960s. Think of Chantal Ackerman, Jean Cocteau, whose speaking voice has influenced me a lot, Chris Marker, Agnes Varda, Yvonne Rainer, Orson Welles, we can multiply forever. Over the years, I've always made videos, films, installations, and radio as a diasporic Greek-Australian subject in post-war Australia. But it's not quite that simple. It never is. For I'm critically concerned with questions of seeing and hearing, which may be hovering beyond our present horizons of creative, cultural, and existential possibilities. Neither here nor there, so to speak, but yonder. But as we do, as Siri Husfit once reminded her readers, one quote can never find themselves yonder. Where the hell is yonder? There is the rub. Art and writing for me share perennially nagging half glimpse, striving towards an undecided elsewhere, to echo Blanchot, Hugh Kenner, Ezra Pound, etc. One never arrives, never. But it's not quite that simple, right? For I'm critically concerned, okay, the essay form has allowed me to fashion a video and film and installation or radio text in the hope of sustaining an informed, speculative and poetic border crossing dialogue between more established art forms and the more recent ones that are salient to contemporary art. In other words, producing a transmedia work that critiques the binary dualisms of postmodernism and Western thought. I became interested in creating art that questions itself as a continuing autobiographical project and articulates an overall attempt to be self-reflexive, open-ended, always motivated to remind ourselves that art is power and it needs to be always untimely, to put it in Nietzsche's terms, creating as a polemic for our time-haunted world. I was virtually born and raised under a Claude Neon milk bar sign. My parents' milk bar at Tempe in the 1950s became for me a Bacheladian theatre of bicultural being, dislocation, surreal reverie, silence, memory, and otherness. It indelibly coloured my understanding of a poetics of in-between creativity, foreignness, time and space. The milk bar's home as an uncanny place of estrangement and wonderment, defined as one's life as, in De Surtur's words, and I quote, being in between. I was always aware of being a hybrid alien who, in order to survive the cultural and ideological contradictions and fictions of my existence, Stanley Cavell's fitting expression of, quote, being a stranger to oneself was paramount in my context. Caught in two worlds, I would always read between languages, between cultures, between art forms. I've been doing this all my life, rummaging amongst the dustbins of various art forms, genres and cultural contexts, authors, filmmakers, etc. By existential necessity, I am what you call in the classical European context a rag picker, a lyrebird, or whatever, magpie. Or if you will, become an ascetic vagabond, to quote Jean-Louis Schaeffer, the French aesthetician. Interest in the multiplying creative encounters that have been and are taking place between art, cinema, video, and the new media technologies. Concerned with the conversations that exist between these different art forms, contexts, etc., locating the ancients next to the moderns in the same room and seeing what may ensue. Treating the past as a vital part of the present and the future, and realizing that analog and digital media are one continuous dialogue of art making. For me, I agree with Isaac, artists are a horse. They make art to suit the context they find themselves in. They don't think categorically, they think acategorically. The better artists do anyway. Through cunning, language, mimicry, and play, I learned to value indifference, exilic marginality. Actually did an honest thesis on that theme. Self-reflexivity and experimentation in order to survive, to make sense of my ongoing life as a hyphenated being, Greek-Australian artist, writer. I cling to fragments, aphorism, quotes, digressions, like a maroon sailor does to floating wreckage. And in this context, I like to echo Michel Serres' wonderful observation, I quote, voyaging begins when one burns one's boats. Adventures begin with a shipwreck. Or, as Nam June Paik said famously to Jean-Paul Fage in his beautiful documentary, Chain the Suitcase, nomad, that's me, Jean-Paul. I'm a nomad, right? And Jean-Paul said, but to be a nomad, how do you get to that situation? He said, you've got to know the rules of the game in order to break them. So that's why I think I keep people typecast me as being a bit fetishist about the past. But I think important artists should have some ancestral knowledge of what Kenneth Burke called the informal vocabulary of their art form. Otherwise, you're just reinventing sliced bread. Okay? As a reluctant, introspective child, acting as a scribe to our many ethnic customers in their Kafkaesque dealings with bureaucracies, the local council, law, education, immigration, and so forth, I truly realised that life as an immigrant, to quote Rilke's The Insignificant Foreigner, as the other, meant absurdity, solitude, and vulnerability. Waiting for the next customer, always waiting, to enter the milk bar's door, it would magically transform itself as a movie screen, a world of enchantment beyond it, busy images of passing cars, customers shopping, screaming kids and teenagers doing the jukebox Cindy Sherman thing. I would dearly caress every image framed by the door with my roving fugitive eyes. I first encountered video in the squats of Finsbury Park, London, in the mid-1970s, where it was used as art, social critique, performance and parody. This was the era of punk music, midnight movies, and regular pilgrimage visits to the National Film Theatre, Southbank. Returning to Sydney in 1977, I attended several short courses on video editing and production techniques at the Australian Film, Radio and Television School. The liquid calligraphic poetry of the electronic medium had bewitched me like a moth to a flame, just like seeing the sign writers plying their ornate art to our milk bar's window, advertising our coming weekly bargains. Since those days, I've always been engaged in a risk-taking, non-authoritarian, hopefully, of producing in-between media, art and writing, denoting Ballure's unspeakable, contaminated images, forms and contexts that are being produced by the daily collision of the screen arts, and anchored in Rilke's belief that the artist or writer is the bearer of cultural memory, making memory matter. This is paramount to my own praxis as an artist, writer, scholar. I create art as works against forgetting. But as we all know, how much as individuals do we misremember art, cinema, literature, and life itself? This question haunts all of us, which is lyrically posed by one of England's sadly underrated film video essayists, Chris Pettit, in his 1999 absorbing video, Negative Space, a homage to the late Manny Farber, one of the great film critics of the English language, someone who was also a painter, and appreciated how the visual arts and cinema so sinuously interwove and connected to each other. If you watch the Academy Awards in the memorial section, there was a portrait of Manny Farber and a book cover of one of his anthology of essays, believe it or not. I don't know what that signifies. Maybe the viral culture is infiltrating the Hollywood machine. Who knows? So Farber's jazz-shaped film criticism was also unprecedented because of its termite cinema focus on the transitory suggestiveness of the imagistic, sonic, and spatial encounter between the film and the spectator. Writing and making art for me is, ontologically speaking, compelling to do. I have no choice. I do not know what else to do. Kafka once described his nocturnal feverish writing as an act, and I quote, of interior emigration. This is something dear to my life, crossing across many different kinds of cultural, generic, linguistic and psychic borders in my life's journey. As Salman Rushdie once said, and I quote, to see things plainly, you have to cross a frontier. Easier said than done. I've always regarded art making, irrespective of the medium, as a fugitive, elliptical enterprise that questions one's own aesthetic, fresh cultural and epistemological baggage. The artist writer self-interrogator as trickster, crossing the thresholds of multiple forms, always attempting to dig deep, mingling things, perennially engage in boundary creation and boundary crossing. To put it more graphically, as Witold Gombrowicz, the Polish author, once put it, to amputate myself from myself. Forever curious, skeptical and suspicious of things, especially in the continuous prison houses we create and incarcerate ourselves in the name of art, cinema, culture, knowledge and society. I think I might just call it a day there because I've a few more pages to go. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, John. So, is this working? Ross, over to you. Ross Gibson is a professor of contemporary arts at the University of Sydney. He's a writer, filmmaker, artist and curator. His recent works include the books Seven Versions of an Australian Badland and the Summer Exercises, the video installation Street X-Rays, 2005, and the durational work Conversations 2, which was shown last year at the Biennale of Sydney. Ross, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Conrad. We just need to switch over the channel from the DVD to the laptop. I'll cut my talk and improvise off some thoughts. Off these sort of words, this system of words, which is a kind of really just an apparatus for thinking. I don't want to convince you of anything. I just want to help us do some thinking about what happens when we try to understand the relationship between cinema and art, broadly speaking, which is the topic of this this session. For me, well, why not start with just this idea of what happens in the shift from single-screen experience to multi-screen experience, particularly spatialized multi-screen experience that's turning up everywhere in the galleries now. Partly there's a technological explanation for that, computer-driven, DVD, loopable, controllable sound and image delivery. But there's something else going on, I'm convinced, and I'm sure you know this too. There's some other need that is cultural, psychological, aesthetic that is being addressed by these spatialized multi-screen environments. What's that about? It might be something to do with some of these words here, something to do with complication, something to do with complexity, something to do with my computer trying to find the network, but it doesn't need the network. What I'll do is talk a bit about, start with a key idea from André Bazin, his observation that the frame around a painting tends to be centripetal. It tends to send your sensibility inside the frame. Futurism and a whole lot of movements, of course, messed with that. But let's just take that idea for a moment. Bazin says the frame in cinema tends to be centrifugal. It tends to dynamically throw out from the frame your thinking and your feeling. The tension that most long-form narrative cinema plays with is how to work with that dynamic that is throwing out from the frame, that centrifugal energy, all of the conflicts, the dynamism and the contention that plays in that centrifugal energy, and how to hold that along a line of disquisition, how to hold that along a mythic line, basically. Myth being a story structure which raises contradictions that you identify, and then the myth resolves, usually emotionally and irrationally, rather than rationally, resolves those contradictions. And in that resolution is a play with dynamics, a play with tension. That's within the single frame storyline version of what's going on the screen. What happens when you bring several screens into the room, all of those screens being centrifugal somehow, all of those screens throwing out from themselves and, if you follow the metaphor, enmeshing with each other, developing environments which catch overlays from one to the other, one screen to the other screen. What happens when our sensibilities grow well enough and astutely enough so that we are comfortable with that multi-screen environment, which evidently we are now? What's going on there? One of the best examples of this, of what's interesting about these multi-screen versions of this dynamic centrifugal kind of impetus of the cinema screen. The best example I've seen is Alexander Sokurov's five-screen version of Spiritual Voices. Spiritual Voices is a five-part, Monday through to Friday, television documentary about Russian soldiers in the Afghani war. When you see it over the five nights, you get a very nuanced understanding of the futility and the mortality that this stupid war was. When you see it as a five-screen version, and Sokurov allowed it to be the five parts shown simultaneously. He allowed it in San Francisco and he allowed it in Melbourne. When you see the five-screen version, you get less of a sense of resolved understanding that you got by Friday night and more of a sense of unending complication, an unending irresolution, an unending contention, an unending difficulty, but a resolved sense of that irresolution, a well-ordered, well-designed sense of the complications is a better word, and I'll explain why it's a better word, the complications rather than the complexities in that world. One of the things that's striking about a lot of loop-based work is that they are resolved works. They are contained. They're closed systems. The loop comes around and comes around and comes around. Nothing enters the work. It's not interactive. I want to make this distinction between complicated multi-screen work and interactive feedback-based work that is often multi-screened as well, and we'll get to that in about 5 minutes or so. But this idea of complication, let's go to the word itself. Complication comes from plicare, to fold. There is the idea that you have a single fabric that is unchanging at its edges. Nothing leaks from it, nothing comes into it. And you do multiple folds inside that single fabric, inside that closed frame. Such situations are complicated. Endless ways that you can do folds inside the complicated system. Endless need to be constantly applied to understanding the seemingly infinite ways that these folds can happen. These are complicated situations. Inside the complicated situations, of course, you have several lines, not just one story, several possible stories, several possible this followed by this followed by this delineations. Therefore, you've got not just the one disquisition that narrative-based cinema tends to give you, the one mythic resolution of the contradictions. In complicated works, and particularly complicated multi-screen works, you've got not a myth but a mythology, a set of stories offering you interweaving, interlacing, contending propositions about what's going on inside the field that's presented, endlessly represented to you. This idea of complication. If we go to complexity, complexity often is used synonymously with complication, but complexity, I think, is one of our defining conditions in the West, and I imagine in the rest of the world as well. But complexity is worth dwelling on as well. It comes from plectare, not plicare, to fold is in complication, plectare, to braid, to be on a loom that has a plectrum bringing new elements into an ever-growing weave of complex matter. The idea that it is an organized set of elements inside the frame, but there's something new coming in, and of course in real complex dynamic situations there's something leaking out often as well, something entropic, heat moving out of a system, for example. So this idea of complexity as a tendency-governed, organized thing which actually has something else coming into it. Intricate interweavings, multi-screen kind of environments have this idea of intricate, endless crossovers of possible lines of thought and lines of feeling that you can take through it. But the key aspect about the complexity is that you yourself, for example, come into the system. You yourself, by coming into the system, change the system somehow. The system is tendency governed and organized. It will respond to you. And that interplay between yourself and the work, that interaction between yourself and the work, is the drama of the work, particularly in these multi-screen situations where your presence is causing shimmering differences around the different screens. I'll give a specific example of this kind of multi-screen complex work in a moment. But what I want us to just think about with this idea of the complex dynamic system and how we have so many of these artworks now that allow us to be with complexity. I want to, just a couple of ideas about complexity. Two of the best writers around complexity, for my mind, are David Rokeby and a South African philosopher called Sillies, Paul Sillies, C-I-L-L-I-E-R-S. Rokeby, a Canadian artist and writer, says that the reason that these complex environments have turned up and that people are visiting them and staying in them and wanting them now so much is that they are a means whereby we can examine the repercussions of our actions. We can come into environments and develop a slow understanding of what happens when we act inside tendency-governed situations. It's a kind of ecological understanding, and that there's a growing awareness at all levels of society that we need to know well, how to gauge and how to even speculate about the repercussions of our actions. Rokeby. Sillies says that to understand complexity, it seems that complexity cannot be modelled. You cannot do a snap freeze of a complex situation as if it were a complicated situation. A complex situation is a complex situation. It's dynamic. Changes are happening at its edges. If you come inside something and freeze it and say that's a model and that's the principles upon which this system works, you've already altered irrevocably the system. You have to be inside it with its changes. That's a damn shame if you want to get certainty about how a complex system is going on. Silliez says it seems that the only thing we can do inside complexity is get inside it and narrate endlessly and multiply what seems to be going on. Tell stories about what's going on inside the complex situation. This is one of the reasons why these multi-screen narrative delineation worlds are so interesting to us now. They're ways to be with multiple possibilities of speculation, disquisition, cause, effect, playing out through time and through action. If we take that to a complex situation, we come inside, we sense the changes that we are causing, we do some actions, we watch the reactions of the world, and we get a sense of how this tendency-governed, organized environment, which is dynamic and skittish, how it is behaving around us in response to us and how we are behaving in response to it. It is these multi-screen complex projects are a way of doing what Silliez says we have to do, which is simply become accustomed to the tendencies. Don't make hard-lined predictions, but become accustomed to the tendencies that move through our world. Now, that's a whole lot of highfalutin abstraction. Can I just do an ad for the project that Kate Richards and I have done for a while? A project called Bystander.
Bystander is an exciting new interactive installation for up to 12 people. It's presented across five screens that are configured into a 7-meter-wide pentagon with front projectors at each apex. Highly responsive to the mass, movement, and position of the audience, the bystander environment is comprised of a sensual kinesthetic particle animation, plus thousands of powerful crime scene images, plus an endlessly variable set of evocative texts, all washed in an extraordinary spatialized soundscape. Called up in real time from a database responding to the behavior of the audience, the world of Bystander is most composed and divulgent when the occupants of the room are most calm and attentive. The system encourages people to be still, to slow the world down and attend to the dramatic material. An attentive audience can create a brooding, compelling narrative. Visitors can unsettle the room, making it more playful but less divulgent.
A sense there, I think, of this world that develops a feedback loop with yourself and that you have to understand the repercussions of your actions, to quote David Rokeby. And then just to go back to our climbing frame of words. The last couple of words down the bottom there, which I haven't addressed yet. A quick run of ideas that are just meant to sort of do little fireworks for a minute. They're not meant to absolutely lock down an argument. One needs 50 minutes for that. But this idea that the single screen mythic operations of narrative in cinema tends to require you to listen, watch, and learn, or at least to engage in a much more didactic relationship from the screen to yourself. If you have been well taught, didactically or not, you'll question and be quizzical with what the screen is offering to you, but it is a didactic broadcast. One of the things that I think the key shifts that's happening in the art world, in the communications world, and in pedagogy, education, this is obvious, is that there's been the shift from a didactic engagement with knowledge to a heuristic engagement with knowledge. Discovery-based learning, pattern-seeking behavior. This pattern-seeking behavior, of course, is one of the things that you do constantly in multi-screen environments. what has this got for me other than chaos? I'll give it 20 seconds. If it's still only sending chaos at me or I feel like it's chaos, I'm probably gone. If I can spend 20 seconds and find patterns in here, I'm already intrigued. I'm already in a heuristic relationship with the work. This idea of pattern seeking, discovery-based engagement with complex environments is one of the reasons I feel kind of good about a whole lot of art now. That there's a lot of art that is not simply didactic, a lot of art which requires your engagement, responds to your engagement in a feedback situation and enhances your own heuristic capabilities, your own discovery-based learning capabilities. And I think that a lot of the multi-screen environments that are turning up in the art world, turning up, as with Raphael's work, in the kind of civic planning world, turning up in the architectural world, a lot of those multi-screen environments, the complicated ones, the ones that aren't responding to the giving repercussions to your actions, and the complex ones, they're addressing real conditions about how we live now. They are addressing ways for us to be in complicated and complex situations. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Ross. Okay, well, we've run over time a little bit, so I think it'd be great if we could just have a few questions. So if the panel wants to come up, and we'll take some questions from the floor.
So apologies to eat into your lunchtime, everyone, but I think it's important to have at least 10 or 15 minutes of questions, and then we'll break for lunch, and then be back about 3 o'clock for Lynette and Ross.
Isaac was going to show his two-screen Dungeness piece. So I think as Ross has brought up this issue of complexity, and obviously Isaac is an artist who makes multi-screen pieces. It'd be interesting, kind of just initially, to get your response to that and to understand what your approach to multi-screen work is, Isaac.
Sorry. I have to say that I really thought those two presentations were amazing, and I've always seen in a sense that I think Foucault was first translated from French into English here, and there's always been a sort of concern, a kind of theoretical concern, I think, for ideas, and I think that was very much reflected in the presentations that, which I particularly enjoyed and thought were quite amazing. So, I think that really we've been talking about this whole question of new technologies and how they kind of influence the subjectivities of artistic practices. And I think really and truly that we're sort of in a way. I just think that multi-screen installations are just a kind of visual translation of what we do every day on the computer, that we multitask, that we're emailing, we're sending off, we have all those boxes that open, and you're sort of doing that sort of visual interplay, and everybody's doing it, really. It's just that there's a translation of it into this kind of, space, and it just happens to be the gallery. I don't want to fetishize the gallery, the museum. Lots of problems with museums, lots of problems with galleries, in fact. But also, I think the linearity, of a single screen telling you a story in this sort of way, that sort of dynamic, it's kind of, it can be well done, and some people do it well, and I think that Steve McQueen did it well, and I think, but on the whole, it's fetishized as one way of making work, and I think there are all kinds of ways of making work, and I think that's what's happening. I think it is arcane to fetishize, one medium like against another now. It's kind of stupid, and I think that, that curatorially people have been working with that, and artists have been, doing that, and some people want to hank on to mediums, but that's their business, but I think that's not what I'm hearing here in this kind of more discursive, interesting, interesting presentation. Yeah. I mean, I can talk a little bit more about what I think that is more in my presentation later. Doesn't make much screen work.
So are there any questions from the floor? Lots of hands.
Mine's just a brief question to John. When he was talking about his work, it reminded me of some work I've read about but never seen called Untimely Collaborations by Jalal Jamik, I think. I might have that name wrong, the last bit, and I wondered if you knew about it. Untimely Collaborations, where he works with films from the past, I think, like one of... The film, an Eisenstein film, and then a contemporary film, like a Hitchcock film. Jalal Tufik, you're right, yeah. And it just reminds... The things I've read about him, where he works with the past and he talks about that sort of messing together with the past and the future, producing new works. And I'd wondered if you'd come across his work.
No, I haven't.
But you obviously have. Yeah.
But
I think he's from Beirut, but worked in America. And yeah. Periods, and I think one film was The Mother, and then maybe The Mother out of Psycho.
Maybe if you speak to David McNeil at COFA,
right?
Because he's very interested in Lebanese media, etc. And Jill Bennett and Phil George.
It's just that it reminded me of.
Yeah, I've never heard of that artist. I'm sorry.
Hi, Ross. I think this is almost a point of clarification because you had such a short amount of time. I just really do struggle with this notion of multi-screen equal complexity, single screen, what I think you seem to be hinting at, simplicity. I think you'd agree yourself that students of classical narrative work in both its classical form, experimental form, someone like David Bordwell would say that the masters of montage from the Russians onwards for Hollywood montage sequence designers through to Alain René's work like Shatam Shatam or Muriel, equally the masters of mise-en-scene from Ozu through to Jacques Tati. The systems they built were vastly more complex systems, or even Richard Fleischer's experiments with multi-screen in Boston Strangler are vastly more complex systems than most gallery multi-screen work. And as a case in point, and this is simply a critical difference, the difference to me between the work you referred to, the Sokurov work, as a linear work, to me is a great morally complex text that builds through time and experience. Whereas as a multi-screen work, I just simply personally think it breaks down into incoherence and meaninglessness. But that's a personal opinion. But maybe just some clarity about that point.
Sure. And you're right. I mean, the brevity I had to work with means that I didn't get to talk about how necessary mythic thinking is, how necessary mythic thinking, how we go for it constantly in order to get knowingly limited understandings of highly contradictory and contentious situations, and that it never rests, and that the power of narrative, really, really great narratives, is that it doesn't conclude strongly, that it gives you a sense of provisional organisation by the time you're finished, but you know that there's so much more that you need to understand about what went on there moment by moment, and what was connotated, what was connoted, all the way through by all of the different options that you had for interpretation, and you locked quickly on an option and went along the line. But really great narrative, of course, you go back and you start again and you take other options for interpretation. So, yes, I mean, there's a drive for this narrative understanding, even in the complicated multi-screen works, there's a drive that you take, which is delineated narrative. But it's just a question of how endless, how many times you run at those. And, yes, I mean, Ozu, someone like that, 100 times of watching Tokyo Story, you still haven't taken all the options. You still have to think and feel differently each time. So I didn't want to say, throw out your DVD or buy six more DVDs. I didn't want to say, it's all over with the single screen cognition. And I just wanted to help us think about what's going on in the two different environments. One's not better than the other. They're just differently stimulant somehow. So thank you for the point of clarification.
Let's play devil's advocate. I would say that I do think that we do know kind of through that's called film theory, and so I think that the master discourse has perfected itself, but I think perhaps what artists are trying to do when they're working with computers and digital technologies and all the media are trying to do something else. Maybe that kind of theorization is not as mastered as the one that we know from film studies. So I think, just play devil's advocate, I think perhaps maybe there's something else that's going on. Maybe we should question about subjectivity and artists making the things that they want to make.
To pick up your advocacy, when one tries to develop sort of theoretical understandings of this computational and multi-stimulant sort of work, you have to reach for whole other fields of knowledge to start thinking. You have to reach for gardening theory. You have to reach to you have to reach to thermodynamics.
You just have to reach to John.
Yeah, you have to. You can't have John.
Walt Benjamin.
Yeah. But it's just a way of saying that there's a different sets of discourse to be brought into the understanding of this. It's another way of what Isaac was saying, that the kind of understanding of classical narrative is pretty thorough. There's other issues to explore.
Okay, a couple more questions.
Okay, I actually don't know if I have a question, but it's sort of following on from that, and thank you, panel, for sort of making a nice three-dimensional space here. I'm thinking about, Wagner's total artwork idea and that total immersion, and as we're speaking, the narrative of the cathedral and the multi-screen in the cathedral, and something that we're just all used to in the rest of our lives, and I'm wondering why you think we're bringing that back. We want to go away from a single focus.
For me, it's I know when I'm with art, when there's a chance of some sort of transformative experience, some surprise might happen to me. And I know I'm with art too when I get a sense that somehow or other, a momentary frame has been provided to me to focus on something. And for me, a lot of this multi-screen stuff is a very kind of wobbly moving frame, but a wobbly moving frame that allows me to focus on complex feedback dynamic situations, to be with complexity in a somewhat artificed way, in a somewhat considered way. And that's why it's come back for me. That's something I'd like to know about.
I agree with Ross. For me, art is like a free made carried to another shore of possibilities. I think it was Sontag who said the beauty of an artist is to pierce the narcotic veil society produces on a daily basis in order to show the possibility of another world in that prison. And that, I think when I stand for art, that is to me, I have a conversation. That's all I ask for.
Conversation. Okay, final question.
This is for Ross. You're talking about with the multi-screen work, there's some cultural and psychological need that's coming out that's being addressed by this work, and some people are saying at the moment that the way we use tech is actually rewiring the way our brains work. Do you think that kind of tech is driving this need to have this complexity addressed, or do you think that now it's just that we have the technology and we can use it to express that need we've always had to explore complexity and complication.
It's the chicken egg issue, and it's when I said, well, we're all opening 25 windows on our computers now, that has caused, you know, an ability to be with these complex or more complicated environments. I think it is a chicken egg sort of chase, but I do think that the last 200 years or so of technological development shows, like, let's start with photography and then use the other example, cinema. These forms turn up at the time when large portions of the populace are ready for them, are already hankering for a frame that can address experience that they're already getting familiar with. So, you know, cinema turned up at a time when metropolitan industrialized life with profuse activity in your perceptive frame was everywhere. Bing is cinema to help you address that. So I think chicken and egg is that, well, it's experience first, and these forms turn up and are avidly seized upon at the time that they're needed.
So we evolve with our technology.
Yeah, and we lose stuff with our technology as well.
Okay, I think we're going to have to wind things up there. So I just want to thank the panel, Ross Gibson, John Connemoss, and Isaac Julian. Thank you very much.